either half of MAGA.
No, yeah, but I think it's split. I think on this issue, and you can't just wade into the water on this, there's going to be a sizable decision made that is going to make one half of that contingent pissed off.
So I better just interrupt and say I've forgotten to start the recording. So okay. If you're catching up with this, we've had, oh, it's been the best. It's the best, it's the greatest. But it's out in the ether now, and if you missed it, then there we go. We're on sort of Iran at the moment. Sorry,
but
go.
What else can be said here about Trump's projection of power and how he has lambasted Biden for wars that have happened under his watch? Look, it's been 150 days and we're on the brink of...
It's the 150th day today, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it must be.
Was it yesterday?
Are we almost halfway through? Or no, we're not even close. We're not even really halfway. I'm trying to make myself feel better. But this image of Trump as some sort of protector or preventer of wars in the Middle East, and let alone one that could become another longest war, is just all some false sense of security that he's created, and the party is split. At least MAGA is split. So,
I mean, if there ever was a forever war, Iran and trying to get involved with boots on the ground, that's your badger, right? Far more so than Iraq or even Afghanistan.
They shouldn't touch that. But it's whether the airstrikes are going to achieve what they want them to achieve, which is to disable the nuclear facility, or whether they feel like they can leverage diplomacy through the threat of further violence. And I suspect that's what Trump wants to be able to achieve. I suspect he wants to be able to talk tough, but ultimately solve this through talking, I think. Because if he can achieve that, then he plays to both sides of his party, because he can say that he's achieved the foreign policy objective in Iran without having to go to war in Iran. And I suspect that is probably underlining and underpinning the bluster from him at the moment. I suspect that's what Rubio is working really hard to achieve. But if it does escalate, Israel is vulnerable, because it's a little bit like that the Serb, well, Yugoslav, but the Serb army in 1999, when it was getting bombed by NATO, and NATO thought they were going to take it out in 3 or 4 days, didn't they? But in the end, it took nearly 9 months, and it's because the Serb, the Yugoslav army was designed to hide and avoid the first, the second, third, fourth, fifth wave of enemy strikes, and then come out of the mountains and do the damage. And what analysts are not sure on is the extent to which Iran's capability is doing just that, is riding out the storm, and then it will emerge later on. And the big risk for Israel is the Iron Dome, and we were talking about this just now. The Iron Dome is what protects Israel, but it's just, you know, the Washington Post has reported that they've got 10 days of stocks left. Now, the only people that produce the missiles of the Americans. If the Americans don't sell or can give the missiles to the Israelis, what do they then do? Because if Iran have been sitting on their hands to a certain extent, fired 10 missiles yesterday, it was 150 last week, then Israel really vulnerable.
And this has a connection, of course, because if they're sending these missiles to bolster the Iron Dome in Israel, they're not sending them to Ukraine. So there are wider things here. I would just say one thing. This is basic military principle anyway, but if we go back to the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and what we all, I think, probably now universally admit was the wrong thing to do, how do you check that their nuclear facilities have been put out of order unless you've got boots on the ground? Right? That's the problem. Okay? So it's all very well to, oh, we're going to conduct surgical strikes, and we're, even if they put the bunker busters. How do you know? The only way you can properly check is to have people there on the ground ready to check. And that's a nightmare forever war opening up right in front of you there. Israel can't do it. You know, again, Netanyahu needs war to stay in power. Otherwise, he's going to get prosecuted. Okay, so he needs continuation of the war. The world was going a little bit cool. I'm not saying this is the reason for the war. I'm saying it's a motivation. The world's starting to turn against him on Gaza. So this now provides something else. But as great as the Israeli military and the Israeli secret service is, they cannot militarily dominate the Middle East. Yeah. They can't do it. They haven't got the power. America can't do it. Okay, let's just reflect on the last 50 years of US intervention in the Middle East. Right? Reagan sent troops to Lebanon in 83. That didn't end well. Okay, Somalia, I know that's not really the Middle East, but it's sort of attached. Black Hawk Down era, that didn't end well. Okay, we've got involved, tried to get involved in the Libyan Civil War, the Syrian Civil War, the invasion of Iraq. This is the world superpower militarily. Cannot defeat ragtag groups of people in this area. No, I mean, no one can. The pretense that this is a war that can be won is a complete mirage.
And then that comes back to the point, which is what is the end game? What do both sides want to achieve out of this? Because Iran are not going to give up their ambition for nuclear weapons.
They're going to be motivated now.
But yeah. So you've achieved the opposite of what you wanted to achieve by bombing them at this stage. And the EU, I think, I've been talking about diplomacy is the only answer. The EU's kept a door open to be communicating with the Iranians. But it's really interesting how sidelined the European Union are. And at times of crisis, particularly in the Middle East, it is the Americans that dominate the narrative. And there seems to be almost nothing from anybody else, which I think is still evidence of that, the power that America have in the region and across the world, is that they are the state that people look to for the answers. China's nowhere. China said nothing.
This is not usually their... They don't take much. I don't know if them.
But Iran is.
I think no. Europe, they negotiated. Europe has a complicated past, which means that they're not going to be that forward. You know, because Sykes-Picot, 1915, the whole region was basically split up between the French and the British. Yeah. This has led to. So, I get what you're saying, Bridges, but I don't think that EU's really seen it as an area of competence for them. I think there's too much sort of post-colonial angst in there.
Does China either though?
Iran is, in theory, its ally. They were doing joint naval drills, joint military drills, and it's nowhere. And actually, what you could, but the benefit of all this, perhaps, and the good side of this, perhaps, is that you could, in theory, be looking at a situation where, in 2022, when Ukraine was invaded, we were concerned about the power of autocracies and the rise of autocracies and the threat to liberal democracy across the world. But actually what's probably demonstrated is the weakness of Russia as an autocracy. The consequence of autocracy and corruption and the weakness of its state. The state itself is very weak because power is so concentrated in such a small part of the state. And actually maybe a similar situation here with Iran and how weak Iran is and how consequential decades of sanctions have been on its military technology and its capacity to protect itself and defend itself. And so you could be looking at a situation where two of the three, or perhaps four, of the axis of resistance, as it's been described, are out of the equation. You've got North Korea as one, China as the other. Mm. And I'm not necessarily convinced that particularly states in the EU consider China as the adversary in the same way that America does.
I want to comment something in a minute. I've written something down so you can say that I've written that. What will be the next country to develop its own nuclear weapon?
I think Poland. I think Poland, and I think probably that the UK and the France will facilitate that. That would be my guess.
I don't know if I'm well versed enough to. Poland as in response to the threat of Russia.
Yeah.
Right,
The Baltic states had no. They
I don't the think they got the capacity.
They don't have the capacity.
South Korea, maybe.
Yeah. Ooh, Turkey,
good example.
Right now, that links in with this. That's my call. My call is Turkey. Okay, when you look at the strategic position of Turkey, this is why traditionally, until you know the predominance of America, it was one of the most powerful countries in the world. Or it's Ottoman Empire. It borders Iran, it's got Russia to its north, it's got control of the Black Sea. It's in the middle. And Turkey have been quite quiet about this, which has surprised me because Erdogan doesn't normally. So I'd quite like to know what he's up to, right?
Well, we're talking about, you know, the superpowers that couldn't bring the Middle East to heel. The only superpower that's achieved that is the Ottoman Empire, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, not even
well,
not,
the Romans, I suppose.
Romans, yeah, but we didn't manage it. The French couldn't manage it. The Americans can't manage it. The Turks did, and I think they've got a massive influence. And Erdogan called out the illegal strikes on Iran, sort of Muslim solidarity, even the Saudis did. But it felt a little bit hollow, because I think that, you know, Turkey sees an opportunity where one actor in that region is going to take out another actor in that region, so it doesn't have to, whilst at the same time has growing enormous influence in Syria. It's almost like the Syrian regime is Turkey's puppet and not the Americans' puppet, which is, I think, is really interesting.
I think it's an interesting point that it literally has only just sort of light bulbed into my mind. Why did the Romans manage it, and why did the Ottomans manage it, but other powers haven't? And I think it is to do with religion. Okay, Romans are pre-Islam, so you've got a divided area ethnically, religiously. Divided areas are much easier to dominate. The Ottomans used Islam as the tool of their... And Ottoman rule was quite light. You know, then I always show the kids this map of Iraq under the Ottomans, which was administered in three separate zones, one for the Shia Marsh Arabs, one for the Sunni majority, and one for the Kurdish and Assyrian Christian region in the north. And it was quite a light sort of touch. But yeah, I've only just thought of that. That's an interesting point.
Yeah. Well, but if you've got an Islamic power in the region, does that then lead to potential conflict between Turkey and Saudi about who is going to be that Islamic power in the region? And both are massively funded by Western militaries. Saudi in particular is just basically British kit. And so that's really interesting to see how that plays out between those two potential rivals. But I think that, you know, the long and short of it is that we're on a precipice of some decision or an action that's going to result in something that we're not prepared to be able to put back in the box, because we can't put it back in the box without making some really horrible policy decisions. And this is what Trump's got to try to avoid, isn't it? And we keep talking about Trump, not because we want to keep talking about Trump, but because of how powerful the Americans are. Yeah. You know, they are the only actor we can really talk about as having the solutions to this, because in many respects, they're the only people that have the capability to have any impact over this. Israel can't finish this fight on its own, can it?
No. I mean, but Netanyahu's quite good at starting fights. He's not very good at finishing them. Yeah, Gaza was supposed to be a 1 month operation or something, wasn't it? And it's been going on. Yeah, he's bluster. He's a BSer is Netanyahu, and always has been. He's a chameleon. Before we leave Trump, now there's another couple of things maybe that we can talk about. I don't think if I were a foreign dignitary, not that these things really matter, that I'd be quaking in my boots looking at that military parade in DC the other day.
Come on, talk us through that, Smitty.
It was the most dire thing I've seen in a long time.
Oh, it was horrible. Obviously, it was like the Spicer situation in the 2020 inauguration, or it was the 2016 inauguration, where it was the largest crowd ever. And I think the attendance numbers fell far short of their expectations. It was really sad. There were a lot of adverts as well for the likes of Palantir, and there was
a Bitcoin sponsor.
I think some Trump affiliated watch. Just really dire times. I mean, we turned the White House into a corporate showroom, as evidenced by Musk's showroom on the South Lawn.
I think clearly a lot of the people, the soldiers involved in it, just weren't taking it seriously.
No, I don't know why you would.
I mean, it was the opposite of the kind of smart drill that I used to have to do, marching up and down the square. They're kind of ambling along. One poor dude just holding a drone above his head.
I saw that.
As the rain was pouring down, and this empty field behind him. And then them saying, yeah, this is sponsored by
Coinbase.
Can you imagine pausing, trooping the colour, and saying, now a word from our sponsors, McDonald's? You know, right in the middle of... It was an absolute thing. I mean, people were saying, oh, you know, the British do it with things like trooping the colour. That's very different, I think. That's a traditional...
We're not used to military parades.
Well, nor are we.
Post-Desert Storm. I mean,
we don't march up and down with missiles and things. That's what dictatorships do, and France, to be fair. But then the French have got that revolutionary...
They've got the background to do it. Yeah,
well, it's the kind of, you know... Yeah, we're really tough. It's the inherent kind of lack of confidence that comes out of a revolution, right? Any revolutionary government established through that always has a lack of confidence in legitimacy, would be my argument. Yeah.
The thing that surprised me most about all this is that it was Biden that organised it.
Was it really?
Yeah. It was organised by the previous administration as a celebration of 250 years of the US Army.
Oh, you should have checked that calendar more closely.
Yeah. So actually, it was arranged by the previous administration.
I wonder if that day was changed.
I bet the day was changed to make it Trump's birthday. I'm just going
to. I refuse to believe that Biden wouldn't have double checked that, or he would have been that confident.
I also refuse to believe that there's a single day when the U.S. Army was established.
No, it's loose.
They don't happen like that at all.
It's loose. I actually wanted to pose you a question, unless we wanted to shift elsewhere, but to talk more about the ripple effect of the Israel-Iran conflict and perhaps what that could look like for the Pacific region. I know that the U.S. is moving a carrier into the Persian Gulf. I think we'll have two carriers, which means the U.S. presence will be limited in Chinese waters and in perhaps the South China Sea.
I would not want to be an aircraft carrier captain in the Persian Gulf.
No.
There's no room to maneuver. A speedboat can get you. I mean, I know they've got their carrier group. I know they've got all the things in the world, but sometimes things get through.
What year did that happen? Where the Iranians...
Oh, the USS Cole.
The Cole, yeah.
Yeah, that's 90-something.
So the Nimitz has been taken out of the Indo-Pacific theatre, and it's going to be in the Gulf alongside Eisenhower. So they've got, two of the biggest... two of the biggest ships ever built and going to be parked in the Middle East. And the Americans can afford to do that, of course, because its ally, us, are sending our own carrier strike force into the Indo-Pacific instead.
And we've got the biggest aircraft carrier in the world.
Yeah.
Cyprus.
Yeah, exactly. So we don't need to put hardware in the Middle East because we've got territory.
Which puts a slightly different slant on the old Hegseth and Vance, we don't need you guys.
Yeah.
You're not our guys, yeah. Okay, let's try and do that without Cyprus then.
Yeah, because
because
if we weren't in the Indo-Pacific, then there was no chance that America could bolster its forces in the
And where are those tanker aircraft flying from?
Yeah, they're flying from Lakenhall, aren't they? Where?
Which country's that in?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, we've never done anything. We're some has-been country that hasn't been to war for the last 50 years or something. Isn't that what we are?
Yeah, but so I think the ripple effect is... probably a little bit more vulnerability in the Indo-Pacific. America said, it's just a completely brilliant timing. America basically said on Monday that, Britain doesn't need to keep its expensive fleet in the Indo-Pacific anymore because it doesn't do anything and it costs too much money and we're doing it anyway. And now the only reason they can send their aircraft carrier across to the Middle East is because we've sent ours to the Indo-Pacific. So I think there's a certain irony there. I think the ripple effect there is probably... a China that's more probably bolstered in terms of what its objectives in Taiwan, because actually now America is split across two theatres and it can't be split across three, because however strong America is, it cannot manage what's happening in Ukraine. And as much as the American administration talks about wanting to get Ukraine done, it's gone very quiet on that, and yes, still quietly continues to give arms to Ukraine. So that theatre is ongoing.
Now, we talked about how the Wagner group has been pulled from
Mali. Yeah, they've been pulled out of Mali, but I can't see them going to Ukraine. I imagine they're going to be held for something else that might happen in Tehran, and maybe they'll go to bolster the regime if that continues to collapse, like some Wagner went to Venezuela to keep the Maduro regime up later last year. So I think that, the consequences could be quite significant. I think that for Europe, the consequences are enormous, because the democracies, I think, are fragile. The right is rising, and if you have a second wave of cost of living crisis, just like a second wave of COVID, it locked us down again. Like, you could probably put up with the first wave, but if there's a second cost of living crisis as a consequence of energy prices and an energy price shock, then the resilience has gone out of the system. The appetite for people to put up with that has gone, and if Labour's sort of economic plan collapses because there's no fiscal headroom, because the 9 billion is wiped out because of a second cost of living crisis, the consequences here probably are a reform government. And recent poll yesterday, Labour in third place now behind the Conservatives and Reform. Mr. Vincent's shaking his head because he doesn't agree with me.
It's not going to happen.
But it could happen, and it depends on the extent to which this crisis escalates. If Iran is bombed by America and Iran mine the Strait of Hormuz, it's going to be catastrophic for the price of oil globally. And that only also encourages the Russian regime to continue the war in Ukraine, because for every rise in percentage rise in the barrel, Russia's exports increase in their value, they get more money to fund the war. So I think the Indo-Pacific regime theatre might not have a huge impact, but Europe in particular will be impacted hugely by an escalation that sees the Strait of Hormuz and the Suez Canal closed.
And Russia certainly doesn't have the bandwidth now to back the Iranian regime, at least with substantial.
The Iranian regime is bolstering the Russian regime, right?
Yeah.
With their drone technology, with their artillery shells, with things like that. Now, the reason I'm shaking my head at Bridges' thing, I haven't recalled hearing anything from Reform for a couple of weeks since their fiasco with, what's his name, the chairman who stepped down and then stepped up again.
Yeah, they have kept
their mouth shut. I just think when you look at what happens with a populist right-wing regime in America in 150 days and the chaos that it causes, and you think about the fact that actually in this country we're not locked into that, that even if by some absolute miracle Reform are in a position to win a parliamentary majority in the next 4 years, they've got five at the moment, right? And now I know that could go up, but I think there will be, I just sense a little bit of a retrenchment of the right in Europe at the moment. The AfD have gone a bit quieter. That's largely because Merz is actually being quite right wing.
As is Starmer,
you know, that they're going to take some of that wind out of their sails. I mean, it's a possibility, but I think it's a shrinkingly small possibility for me. But yeah, I mean, I think the Pacific. I think the other thing is, everybody's saying this is an ideal time for China to go for Taiwan, but for a country whose lifeblood is international trade, I mean, that would absolutely cripple them. A war in Taiwan would absolutely cripple Chinese export markets. And coming on top of the financial problems they're already having, I think that could almost push things over the edge. I think the Chinese want stability. I don't think they want instability. Why would a businessman want instability?
Yeah. I was thinking under the impression that this would be the best time for China to advance its interests in the region.
Yes,
and it very well could get worse on the U.S. fighting in two fronts, assuming that there's no end in sight for the Iran-Israel conflict, but that is a good point.
I think far more likely that China says to Taiwan, look, there's only one reliable partner now.
Yeah.
Right, so we're not gonna threaten your thing, but why don't you come into some kind of regional understanding with us? Because America has become a fundamentally I don't think the Chinese are militarily going to take Taiwan
in the Hong Kong in the Hong Kong format.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I'm not saying it'll be genuine or that it will last or all that two systems thing which was a complete lie. But I could be wrong on this, but I think it's such a risky venture that it's such a difficult military venture as well. And in doing it, you probably destroy all the things that China wants. Wars destroy stuff.
Yeah. And Xi's legacy is on the line. He doesn't, if he invades Taiwan and is unsuccessful, the man's gone. He doesn't survive that. Then what happens to the regime? And that's the issue, isn't it?
Is he about to go?
They're so fragile. The autocracies can't survive failures in that context. Because when you hinge your legitimacy on threats and the requirement for your military and your military is unsuccessful, it can't work, then you are incredibly vulnerable. Yeah. The Iranian regime now is vulnerable. The Russian regime is vulnerable. And China's probably looking at it thinking, we don't want to be in that same position.
Even the guy who's seen as the arch kind of imperialist warmonger, isn't it? It's Churchill again. Jaw is better than war, because war just destroys stuff. It doesn't build anything. None of these problems are going to be solved militarily. None of them. And the sooner people realise that, the better. But I suppose people have been sounding that alarm since Thucydides, haven't they?
Yeah.
Which is quite a long time ago. In fact, probably before then. We done for today.
Done for today. next week Thursday, but the week after we need to move it to a different day of the week so we can probably wait.
So for all those thousands of live listening listeners out there, we may have to change that.
Yeah, Mr. Waters, I think he's the only one, so if you're listening.
I don't want to check the numbers if I had access.
Right, cheers all. We'll see you next week.